advise you to fasten your seatbelts because we're leaving Strasbourg and Brussels for New York. As I'm the genuine outlier here, I've been asked to talk about the evolution in broad acceptance.
Speak softly, carry a big stick. I think that's your motto. Okay.
Evolution and broad acceptance of the responsibility to protect and the responsibility to rebuild. Two norms, if that's what they are, and we may want to come back to the question of the status of these things, but two norms that were accepted unanimously by heads of state and government meeting in New York at the World Summit in 2005. Now, I make no reference at all to the Council of Europe. Indeed, this will be the only reference I make to the Council of Europe. So, while Anne is quite right, this is meant to be an exercise in comparative perspective, I think that the implications of what I may have to say need to be drawn out. And that would be interesting to do. Now, assuming that we can take as a given the broad acceptance of these principles, what explains this success? And that's largely what I've tried to talk about in this paper. I don't think I can really call it a paper. I think I can call it a series of observations. But relative success in relation to a series of failures by others earlier, some of them relatively recent in relation to this initiative. So it's quite interesting to reflect on why at this particular time was there much greater acceptance of principles that failed to gain acceptance at earlier times. Now, we've been talking about norm entrepreneurship. I think it's fair to say that central to the 2005 adoption of the World Summit outcome document, it's in this outcome document that the principles are enshrined. Explicit reference to the responsibility to protect, and this is a responsibility to protect populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. The responsibility to rebuild is arguably implicit. It's implicit in the commitment to the establishment of a peace-building commission, and I'll talk about that towards the end. I have, for the benefit of anybody who has the papers, attached an annex which has excerpts from the World Summit outcome document that are relevant to these two principles. Now, I mentioned norm entrepreneurship does play an important role here. Certainly, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was a very, very important player in this story. And Annan was particularly concerned about the failure of the United Nations to take effective action in response to the actual or threatened commission of mass atrocity crimes in Rwanda, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Kosovo in the mid to late 1990s, and by the unilateral use of force by NATO member states against Serbia over Kosovo, and concerned about the diminished credibility of the United Nations as a result of these experiences. And he challenged states in 1999 to devise a constructive approach to the seemingly irreconcilable and increasingly acute tension between sovereignty and the defense of human rights. 2 years later, a response was forthcoming by the Canadian government-sponsored International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, referred to sometimes as the ISIS Commission, which issued a report titled Responsibility to Protect. And with the recommendations of that commission in hand, Annan labored to promote acceptance of these principles, modified significantly among UN member states, leading to their eventual adoption, further modified at the World Summit. Now, Jeff raised the question of counterfactuals this morning, and a mental exercise. I mean, if Annan had not led with this, would we have arrived at the point where we have arrived? It's very hard to know. I mean, the Canadians, among other states, were certainly very strongly interested in promoting particularly the responsibility to protect. It's very, very difficult to know what would have happened if he weren't so central to the story. There are cases in the International Criminal Court, and the norms associated with it did not come into existence with the same degree of support from the UN Secretary General. There was no opposition, but it wasn't something that owes its success, I'd say, to the entrepreneurial, the normative leadership, if you will, of the UN Secretary General. I mean, that had a lot more to do with states taking initiative. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know in the absence of Annan's contribution whether it would have had comparable success. But clearly he was a pivotal figure, but he wasn't the only significant figure. I mentioned already the Canadian government, which sponsored this commission, but also some of the ISIS commissioners, most notably Gareth Evans, who former foreign minister of Australia, who co-chaired the commission. They were critical agents, as was the UN High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change, which Annan established in 2003, and to which he appointed Evans, which I think was very important, and whose endorsement of the responsibility to protect, because this was now an internal panel. The ISIS was external to the UN, this was now internal, but their endorsement of the responsibility to protect facilitated the articulation of Annan's own recommendations and paved the way for the incorporation of the responsibility to protect in the into the World Summit outcome document. But in addition, the responsibility to protect received support, very important support, from a number of non-governmental organizations, many of them with Canadian encouragement, which not only promoted support for R2P, as it's called, worldwide, but they also actively lobbied permanent delegations in New York in particular. And then there were a number of states, apart from the Canadians, who were also key to the promotion of R2P, among them Britain. Britain, whose Blair government had sought earlier and unsuccessfully to build a political consensus among the permanent five members of the Security Council and the G77, the developing countries, in support of humanitarian intervention after the 1999 Kosovo War. And then several African states as well, including South Africa, which, although concerned about the prospect or possibility for abuse of R2P, abuse using it as a pretext for intervention, that was their chief concern, they felt that the adoption of the principle would contribute to the enhancement of human rights and security on the African continent. So they were very key to generating support, particularly among Global South, countries in the Global South. Now, this latter point, I think, is worth bearing in mind. And again, I'm going to invoke something that Jeff said this morning about context, because I think that the success of R2P reflected not only successful non-norm entrepreneurship, but also broad recognition of the need for reform in this particular area. I think, Gwen, you talked about ripeness of the moment, if I'm not mistaken, this morning, and I think that it is fair to say that the moment was ripe for norm entrepreneurship in this particular sphere, that a large number of states, particularly, as I said, after these crises and the inability of the United Nations to respond effectively to them, a number of states perceived the need to strengthen international capacity for more effective response to the actual or threatened commission of mass atrocity crimes. Now, it's interesting that the U.S. was not among leading proponents of R2P. Indeed, just a few weeks before the World Summit in 2005, Bush appointed John Bolton, a strident critic of the United Nations, as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. And Bolton very nearly succeeded in completely unraveling the tenuous consensus that had been achieved among states. And as a consequence of his efforts, very soon China and Russia were expressing deep reservations about R2P as well. And India, an influential member of the G77, also became much more vocal in opposition to R2P at this stage. And it was only because the U.S. and Indian permanent representatives were overruled by their superiors, Condoleezza Rice in the case of the U.S., Mohan Singh in the case of India, that their opposition was overcome. So it's interesting also to reflect a little bit on contingency in these particular cases, because if they had not been restrained, it's conceivable that the initiative would not have been successful. But these states clearly did not want to be seen to have been responsible for the summit's failure. So that says something also about the dynamics of norm adoption. But it also says something about the particular role of states in these processes. And what mattered in this particular case wasn't necessarily strong support on the part of key states, because that was lacking, but weak opposition. Although, as we also know, the lack of commitment by key states can have consequences for the implementation of the norm after it has been formally embraced. Now, of course, in the case of the Obama administration, that's been less of a problem because the administration has been a strong advocate of R2P. But entrepreneurship was important in the broadest sense of the term. I'm talking about a number of different agents who were active in the promotion of support for this norm. But the other thing that was very important and explains why there was success in this particular instance, in contrast to antecedent attempts, particularly, as I mentioned, the Blair government's efforts, and that's because of the way in which critical issues were framed. Evans has written quite a lot about this, and he says quite rightly, I think, that R2P gained international traction in part because it was articulated in a particular way, with the emphasis first and foremost on the responsibilities of states themselves to protect their own populations, rather than on the right of other states to intervene militarily. And as a consequence of this, we see a shift away from humanitarian intervention and attempts to arrive at consensus around the criteria for intervention, a shift away from intervention to responsibility. Now, the outcome document doesn't exclude the possibility for military intervention, provided that it's Security Council mandated. But in any event, it was perceived very broadly to represent a significant enough shift that it could allow for buy-in. And we know from statements that were made by countries at the World Summit in 2005 and subsequently that they were much more comfortable with this formulation than they had been with, as I said, earlier efforts to achieve a consensus around humanitarian intervention. Now, the reframing of this issue has entailed a broader view of responsibility in two important respects. And this also, I think, has been critical to generating support for the norm or principle. First, as I said, as it's been formulated, it recognizes that the responsibility lies primarily with each individual state vis-a-vis its own population, but also because R2P comprises a wide range of activities, from preventive measures to restorative efforts. And this contributed further to shifting the emphasis away from military intervention. Indeed, in the original formulation on the ISIS report, the Responsibility to Protect, they envisioned a tripartite continuum with starting with a responsibility to prevent, a responsibility to react, and a responsibility to rebuild. This is where the responsibility to rebuild has some relationship to the responsibility to protect. So that, as I said, also helped because it further diluted the emphasis on intervention, military or otherwise. Now, just to conclude, I'll say a few words about the responsibility to rebuild. I've referred to it, together with the responsibility to protect, as a norm or principle. I think it's fair to say, at least in the World Outcomes Summit document, that the outcome document at the World Summit, that it's more of a concept than it is a principle. As it appears in the ISIS report, it's very clearly there are very strong normative underpinnings. If I just to quote from that report, it says the responsibility to protect implies the responsibility not just to prevent and to react, but to follow through and rebuild. And some of you remember perhaps Colin Powell during the Iraq War invoked what he called the pottery barn principle, which, as he put it, was if you break it, you buy it. Interestingly enough, that isn't the basis on which Pottery Barn operates, but that's beside the point. But the implication was that you have a responsibility as an intervener for the consequences of your actions. And as I said, that was reflected in the ISIS report. The basis for responsibility to rebuild in the outcome document, however, seems to be a lot more pragmatic, a recognition that post-conflict states often require extensive assistance to ensure against the recurrence of conflict, and not so much any sense of duty or responsibility towards states that are emerging from conflict. And then the last thing I'll say, because I think I'm at my 15 minutes now, but again, just to pick up on a comment that was made in the last presentation about discretion, I think that the ambiguity of commitments would also be a factor that explains the key to the successful adoption of the responsibility to protect. And we know from Alex Bellamy, some of you may know, an Australian scholar has written a superb account of the World Summit. Anne referred earlier to value of good data, and Alex, among others, has provided us with enormous data. So we really know quite a lot about the thinking by various key figures leading up to and including the World Summit. But we know that from his account that there was very little support for the suggestion that the responsibility to protect created any obligation on the part of the United Nations to take collective action when states fail to protect their own populations from mass atrocity crimes. And indeed, as expressed in the outcome document, the only responsibility that the international community has, acting through the United Nations, is to, quote, to use appropriate diplomatic, humanitarian, and other peaceful means. Now, should peaceful means be inadequate and national authorities are manifestly failing in their responsibility to protect their populations, then the international community will only be prepared, and this is the operative language, but not obliged to take collective action in response. Now, of course, living as we do in an anarchical society, nothing could compel states anyway to take action, collectively or otherwise, in support of humanitarian aims. So, just to conclude, it's an interesting case, this one, a very, as I said, data-rich case, which suggests an important role for norm entrepreneurship or norm leadership, depending on how you want to view the role of Canada and other states, as well as the various commissions that played a role in reframing the language to make responsibility to protect acceptable. But also the climate was a very important one. There was, as I said, a propitious climate for norm entrepreneurship. And I think it's against this backdrop that Annan, encouraged and supported by a number of states and organizations, not only succeeded in putting responsibility to protect and responsibility to rebuild on the agenda, but gaining broad support for it. So what lessons we draw from this for the Council of Europe, well, I suppose we have to leave that for discussion. That's one advantage to going over your limit, isn't it? You don't have to answer the question.
Thank you very much.